If you're a virus these days, it's Green Acres everywhere you go.
Fresh air!
Times Square!
From a virus's perspective, these are the best of times. City life, country life, habitats, it's stretching out far and wide in a 6 billion person world. The fertile soil of humanity.
You are my wife.
Goodbye, city life.
Green Acres, we are there.
For viruses, this show may never get canceled. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning with a virus eye view of the world. It's Wednesday, May 6th. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm joined this morning by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hello, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about why the U.S. is so focused on Pakistan when the rest of the world just isn't. And new research shows that our fish friends feel pain, and does that change whether or not you want to eat sushi? We've got the latest birth control shot. It's for men. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
The Treasury Department is telling Bank of America to find cash fast. It says the bank needs almost $34 billion more to make it through the rest of the economic downturn. That's according to executives at the bank. Bank of America has already received $45 billion in TARP funds. President Obama holds trilateral talks with the leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan at the White House today. The talks come as tens of thousands of civilians flee the Swat Valley in Pakistan in the wake of increasing conflict. Pakistani journalist Ismail Khan says government-imposed curfews make it harder to evacuate.
They are taking long and arduous routes and journeys. Most of them walk on foot for miles and miles to bypass the security checkpost, to bypass militant checkpost, to reach the refugee camps.
Refugees are leaving amid reports that a government peace deal with militants is about to collapse, right?
And in Afghanistan, the Red Cross confirmed that dozens of people, including women and children, died in a coalition air raid in the western part of the country this week. Here's Jessica Berry of the Red Cross.
When our team arrived in the villages yesterday afternoon, they saw dozens of bodies in two areas where the fighting and the bombing had taken place. In two villages, they saw graves and they saw people being buried.
American forces are investigating the incident, and Afghan President Hamid Karzai asked for an official inquiry yesterday. Plus, the U.S. Navy says it won't send a California-based ship on a planned humanitarian mission to the South Pacific. One crew member has H1N1, or the swine flu, and about 50 other sailors have symptoms. Lieutenant Sean Robertson says the Navy is taking every necessary precaution.
We're in the process now of cleaning and disinfecting the ship, and we're doing that in accordance with Centers for Disease Control guidelines.
And there are now more than 400 confirmed cases of swine flu in the U.S.
Look at the baseball standings. The Boston Red Sox have won 5 in a row over the New York Yankees, and the Boston Globe lives to see another day. According to the Globe, its largest union reached a tentative deal with owner and our partner, the New York Times Company, early this morning. The union agreed to massive pay cuts, unpaid furloughs, and changes in the lifetime job guarantee. So that's Boston 6, New York zip. On Wall Street, the Dow and S&P were flat yesterday. The Dow opens at 83.65. The S&P starts trading at $8.99. All right. If there was a contraceptive for men, would they use it? Well, of course they would. Who should bear the responsibility for birth control? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Boy, it's so much easier when you have a military strongman to deal with. That's on the table at Summit Day at the White House. South Asia, of course, on the agenda. There are three players talking. President Obama, the leader of Pakistan and Afghanistan, all sit down to talk about strategic issues of mutual concern. During the 8 years of the Bush administration, it was Pervez Musharraf, a general, perhaps making it easy to project both strategic and domestic issues in the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan. But Asif Ali Zardari, the popularly elected Democratic leader of Pakistan, is also weak and unpopular in his own country. And that complicates diplomacy, potentially. I spoke with the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus earlier this morning. He joined us from London. When we spoke, I asked Jonathan how having an unpopular civilian, as opposed to military leader in Pakistan, challenges the Obama administration as it seeks out its own strategic goals.
Well, first of all, I don't think John one should over-egg how good things were when there was a military regime in Pakistan. I mean, clearly, many of the problems that exist today have their roots during that period. I think the problem for the Americans now is that this comprehensive approach from President Obama that was unveiled just a short while ago in March, that began as an attempt to link Pakistan into the problems in Afghanistan, an awareness that you couldn't deal with the problems there without dealing with the insurgency in Pakistan and coming across the border as well. But I think in the very short space of just a few weeks, I think the focus has shifted much more to Pakistan itself and the intractability of the problems there. And although there is a democratic government, the army is still a crucial institution. And the problem for the Americans is to convince both the army and the government that the real challenge the country faces is from within, from the domestic insurgency, and not the external threat from a traditional enemy, India.
Well, making that argument late last month was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Listen to this, Jonathan.
With this supplemental request, we are seeking funding of $497 million in assistance for our work in Pakistan, which will support the government's efforts to stabilize the economy, strengthen law enforcement, alleviate poverty, and help displaced citizens find safe shelter.
All domestic Pakistani concerns there, the Secretary of State is laying out. Is that the scale of the aid that's going to be required?
I think it's an indication of the scale of the problem, certainly. I think it's interesting that President Obama has set out his stall in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the idea that this is a war that America intends to win. But the phrase that you don't hear much coming from American spokesmen is nation building. But I think in reality, it's quite clear that there is a huge amount of nation building going on in Afghanistan, where the United States is a direct actor on the ground, but equally at one removed. And you heard there from the list of the menu, as it were, of things that the Secretary of State set out, nation building in Pakistan is equally important, albeit indirectly. The United States is not a direct player. But that, of course, speaks to the very long-term nature of the problem. And that is obviously a complicating factor, too.
You know, at some point, and you referred to this sort of implicitly in your opening statement there, Jonathan, the Bush administration had to essentially say, you know, Musharraf is too weak to be dealt with. Is there a point at which the Obama administration has to make the same kind of difficult choice about Zardari? And behind the scenes, Ashfaq Kiani, the military leader, is there and has enormous clout inside Pakistan.
Well, he has enormous clout, but it's not clear that the Pakistan military are any more enthusiastic about significantly confronting the insurgents than is the government. So that's a problem. I think, though, the Americans have to back the democratic leader that they have in place, and we heard that very clearly from Mr. Holbrooke, the administration's point man, yesterday. I think it's interesting, though, that they're not leaving any diplomatic stone unturned. You're seeing the Americans reaching out to the main opposition leader in Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, also reaching out to Saudi Arabia, who widely seen as a backer of Mr. Sharif, but also a country which has some diplomatic clout and influence with Pakistan. So it's a comprehensive approach, if you like, from the White House on many, many tracks.
Indeed, Bob Gates is in Saudi Arabia, Secretary of Defense, actually pulling some of those levers. Finally, is the U.S. at odds with the rest of the world in assessing and declaring the significance of the so-called Pakistan problem?
I don't think it's at odds in terms of the assessment of the centrality of what's going on in Pakistan. Now, you can understand that's something we in Britain sense very strongly. We have a large community of people whose origins come from that part of the world. Also, of course, British security and intelligence people tell us that the vast bulk of potential terrorist attacks being planned for Britain emanate from that part of the world. I think that where there is something of a difference is the, if you like, the shrillness sometimes, the sense of impending catastrophe that one hears from Washington. I don't think that's entirely shared in London, in the Foreign Office and so on. I think there are certainly very strong concerns about stability in Pakistan, but as yet, no real alarm bells ringing that Pakistan is likely to go under. But that, of course, isn't to underestimate the scale of the problems involved.
Well, Well, we'll listen for the alarm bells at the White House later today. Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, talking about South Asia and the Pakistan-Afghanistan situation as leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan sit down with President Obama at the White House today. Farai?
Another big issue with international ramifications. The Justice Department has been investigating the lawyers who wrote the secret torture memos. They authorized brutal interrogations, including waterboarding, wall slapping, and head slamming. The final version of that investigation could be released late this month. Today, our partners at the New York Times report the Justice Department will recommend that the lawyers who wrote the memos should not be criminally prosecuted. Scott Shane is the national security reporter for the New York Times. So if the government does go ahead and say, hey, we're not going to prosecute you, what are the other options in terms of dealing with this?
Well, the most likely option is, assuming that this report ends up as critical as the early drafts appear to have been, is that they could recommend to state bar associations some kind of disciplinary action, ranging from a letter of reprimand or something like that, all the way to disbarment.
Now, there has been some action by the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild to really look at disbarment as a choice. But how big is that movement to really think about disbarring people like Haynes and you, who are some of the key people?
Well, this particular report focuses only on Justice Department employees, and the three key people who were authors of these interrogation memos were John Yoo, who's now a professor at Berkeley, law professor at Berkeley, Jay Bybee, who's now a federal judge in Nevada, an appeals court judge, and Stephen Bradbury. And any of them could face some kind of sanction from this report. We were told that at least in an early draft, bar actions were recommended for John Yoo and Jay Bybee, but not for Stephen Bradbury. But this report, which has been in the works for 4 years, more than 4 years now, is still a little bit of a work in progress. It was the subject of a sort of tussle with the former Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, who was very unhappy with the draft. And now the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, still has to approve a final draft this month.
Well, I actually want to, you know, talk about how universities are responding to us. Here's a little bit of Condoleezza Rice confronted by students about the Bush policy choices.
Foreign policy is full of tough choices, very tough choices. The world is not a bunch of easy choices in which you get to make ones that always feel good.
I'm aware, but even in...
Well, this is a situation where a lot of these folks have gone in and out of academic context, including Rice, but also you. And there's a question always about whether student activism can help be one of these levers that raises questions. Is this important at all, or is it really just the politicians who have leverage?
Well, I think one thing that certainly John Yoo has found, and I think Condoleezza Rice is finding, is that this very emotional torture issue is very hard to escape. She made those remarks at a Stanford dorm, was sort of confronted by a student. That immediately went up on YouTube and went around the world. And then over the weekend, she spoke to a private school group in Washington, was confronted by a news team from Al Jazeera outside to talk. And again, was sort of pressed on her role in approving these brutal interrogation methods. And for Mr. Yoo, there's been some effort to strip him of his tenure at Berkeley, which would be necessary if they were going to dismiss him. You know, it's not clear how any of that's going to end, but right. It certainly makes life uncomfortable for these folks.
Yeah, all definite multifaceted situations. Scott Shane, national security reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up, the scientific details of a possible hormonal contraceptive for men. But who should bear the responsibility and cost for birth control? Men, would you be willing to actually take a contraceptive shot? Robert emails us with one good point. What about condoms and their role in preventing sexually transmitted diseases? This is one area in which a little more seriousness might be in order. We are serious that you call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE on this subject or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right?
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what people have to say about that. And here's another issue. A lot of us are very concerned about what we eat, and including the meat. And if you feel guilty about eating cows and pigs, but you don't have any problem downing a tuna sandwich, we have some bad news. There's a new study that says that fish feel pain.
Get out. Joseph, my dad told me that the hook does not hurt.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, there's a lot of things parents say out of kindness. But now we have Joseph Garner, an assistant professor of animal behavior and well-being at Purdue. And thanks for joining us. Tell me, what does your research show that earlier research hasn't?
First of all, I should give credit where credit's due and mention that this is a project which I worked on with Jannike Nordgren, who's a PhD student from Norway who visited us to do the work. And in a nutshell, there's a lot of people who will argue that fish don't feel pain because everything that they do is just a reflex.
No, and this is what your dad says to you when you're pulling the hook out of the fish, right?
Right, exactly. But I mean, I think actually, if you've been following the news that sprung up around this article, then I feel quite sorry for the anglers actually, because I think they've been bearing the brunt of the reporting, but. In a nutshell, what we showed was that the fish were doing things that couldn't possibly be reflexes, and in fact were doing things that looked an awful lot more like what we do when we process pain. That is, they were integrating these experiences into other behaviors long after the pain had gone away.
You know, what fascinated me is, you know, when you talk about integrating it into other behaviors, if you're crossing the street and, you know, a car sideswipes you, you might be cautious about crossing the street. And it sounds like, from your experience, these fish became really nervous and really cautious. Tell us a little bit more about that.
We basically built a fish version of a very standard pain investigation apparatus, which just heats up a point on the body at different rates. And I really hasten to add, nowhere near a temperature which would injure the fish. So if this was to happen to you, you'd feel that heat stimulus, and then seconds later, or even just a fraction of time later, it'll be gone. And we gave fish morphine, which is a painkiller, or we gave them saline, which is a placebo. Both groups of fish reacted to the stimulus, so they showed the reflex. But then a long time later, when they were in their tank swimming around, the fish that had received saline were showing all of these, like you say, these sort of wariness, fearfulness behaviors, whereas the fish that had morphine, which would have blocked the pain and prevented them from experiencing it, looked perfectly normal.
Now, how much, you know, you said that, you know, perhaps jokingly, that you feel bad for the anglers. There's always this question of, you know, what it is that, you know, we deserve as human beings when we eat animals. You know, The Omnivore's Dilemma was a hugely popular book by Michael Pollan. Is this really, you know, were you looking at this from a practical standpoint in terms of food consumption, or why did you even pursue this research?
There's sort of two reasons for doing this kind of research. One is that, you know, all scientists have sort of a secret nerdy fascination that they like to pursue. And in my case, I'm just really fascinated by what it's like to be another animal. So what is it like to be a fish or a mouse or a crocodile or a dolphin? I'm actually much more interested in the quote-unquote boring animals, because they're not. And the broader issue is that in this field of animal well-being, what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide the sort of key piece of objective data that helps people who are locked in these debates find some common ground that they can discuss and find resolutions around.
But Joseph, from the perspective of someone who wants to be a fish, okay, how do you respond to the fish that comes up to you and says, so Joe, what about a hook in your lip? Don't you understand? You know, why did you need to go through this study?
You're making an absolutely excellent point. I mean, I think if we work with animals as researchers, or if we eat animals, or we farm animals, then we absolutely have a fundamental responsibility to spend the time to figure out what those practices are like for the animals involved, and if they do involve pain and distress, to figure out ways to minimize them.
Well,
I think that principle is enshrined in U.S. law. I mean, I don't think that's exactly very controversial.
Well, I'm sure that there will be some controversy, particularly when it comes to people who are making ethical decisions about what they eat. You know, certainly there are people who are vegetarians because they just like vegetables, and other people who do it for ethical reasons. This may change that. Joseph Garner, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Joseph Garner is an assistant professor of animal behavior and animal well-being at Purdue University and co-author of this new study linking fish to pain. There's all sorts of news going on today, and a person to deliver it named Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. The time is just coming up to 27 minutes past the hour. President Obama meets with the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan in Washington today. The president is expected to press Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari to do more to help with the growing militant violence within Pakistan's borders. President Obama is also seeking wider cooperation between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the president plans to address the nation from the White House afterwards. The U.S. government says that Bank of America needs almost $34 billion to survive the rest of the economic downturn. That's according to bank executives. If the bank is unable to raise that much money from selling assets or stock, it will have to go back to the government, and the bank has already received $45 billion in TARP funds. The Treasury and Federal Reserve are expected to issue TARP repayment guidelines today. Banks that want to free themselves from government restrictions may have to do more than simply pay back the money they owe. They may also have to show that they can operate without backing by the FDIC. 1,200 homes in Southern California are being evacuated as a 400-acre wildfire grows. Firefighters are working to control the flames. About 1,200 homes have already been evacuated. NATO troops from 18 countries are taking part in drill exercises in the Republic of Georgia today, and Russia is condemning the move. Russia says that it's a provocation following its war with Georgia last year, and yesterday soldiers attempted an unsuccessful takeover of the Georgian government. And finally, the classic comedy actor Dom DeLuise has died. Here's Dom in the Mel Brooks movie, Blazing Saddles.
Give me the playback and... watch me bang it!
Throw out your hands, take out your tush, hands on your hips, give them a push, you'll be surprised, you're doing the French mistake, voila!
I can see
have
him.
Have you got it?
Yes!
I can see him like jumping around.
Dom DeLuise, dead at 75.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, we're going to hear some of the scientific details of a new hormonal contraceptive method for men. Men, would you be willing to take a contraceptive shot? Whose responsibility is it for birth control, cost, and practice? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you know, Farai, it looks like a long losing streak in Detroit just might be over. And I don't mean the 0-16 record of the Detroit Lions.
What are you talking about, John?
Well, they got a new elected mayor, David Bing. We've been talking about it all week, and it really represents an opportunity for a civic leader to come into a community where things could not be at a lower ebb in terms of confidence and turn things around. I mean, it may be depressing to imagine being mayor of Detroit right now, but I think it's probably a real opportunity.
Well, you know, our partner or our associates at WDET have been really great to us, and we've been able to discuss this over and over again. The city has a lot of moxie. And in fact, we have an exciting opportunity to talk to the new mayor-elect. His name is David Bing, a former Detroit Pistons basketball star who had never run for political office. He is now going to be the city's next mayor. Mayor-elect, welcome and congratulations.
Well, thank you so very much. Looking forward to it.
Well, first off, why the heck are you running, or now elected to run a city that is so profoundly troubled that the average house sale right now is under $10,000.
Well, you're doing that because you love the city, you love the people. This is where I've been for the last 42 years, and the city needs help. The city needs leadership. The city needs a change in direction, and I felt very passionate about that because we got so many good folks here who are in need, and I've been fortunate in my life to have opportunity that a lot of these folks don't have. And I want to give them some hope so that we don't just quit on ourselves.
So we can hear folks in the background. I'm sure you've been running around with your victory fresh on you all day. Where are you right now?
I am at the hotel at the DoubleTree and been up since about 6 o'clock this morning with interviews. So it's been a day of work already. And this is what I need to get ready for.
Well, congratulations. And you referred there a moment ago to your success in the auto parts business, Mayor-elect Bing, and also the fact that you're a former Detroit Pistons basketball star. I don't mean any disrespect, but lay it out for me. Does your early sort of game plan here in the mayor's office in Detroit involve a fast break, or is it a delay game to your election that you have to run for again in November?
Well, it surely won't be a delay game. I don't think that's what people voted me in to do. They want a fast break. They don't want four corners, so I won't give them that. I'm going to get out running. I started this morning at about 6 o'clock, and this is going to be my life here for a while, and I'm looking forward to it. There are a lot of things that need to be done, a lot of changes that we need to undergo. And it's got to be a situation where everybody's got to think differently because we have to come together. We can't continue to try to operate in a microcosm and say it's Detroit against the world. We need help, and I'm going to reach out as best I can to get the kind of support that we need that can help change our direction.
So, of course, former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was convicted. Interim Mayor Kenneth Cockrell now returns to serve as city council president. He was your opponent. Now you're going to have to work with him. How's your relationship?
Just because we competed against each other doesn't mean that we can't work together. I think as a professional, regardless of the situation, as long as the goal is to do what's right for Detroit and its citizens, then we should be on the same page. We won't agree on everything, I'm sure, but for the most part, if we do what's right for the citizens of Detroit, we can move it forward.
Mayor-elect, you know, voters were talking to us on the program all week about how it's a matter of survival in Detroit, that the reality is merely surviving. And you've also had, the year of the Kwame Kilpatrick problems, which has reduced the credibility of civic institutions in Detroit to the lowest it could conceivably be. How do you, as a politician, address the issue of survival by voters and raise the sort of credibility of City Hall in this community?
Well, I think my personality and my credibility that I've been able to achieve over the 42 years that I've been here will help resolve that. I'm not so cocky, nor am I naive to think that we're going to change this thing overnight. But I think with a different leader, somebody who comes to the table that's fresh, that's different, that's credible, that you can trust, all of those things are very, very important. And because I have a relationship with our business community, they've known me for a long time. We've worked together. We've been in deals together. And I think that's going to be very helpful. So I don't, once again, by any stretch of the imagination, think that it's going to be an easy job. But I'm up for it.
Well, what is your vision for Detroit? If, you know, name one thing that you're going to set out to do for Detroit and one outcome that you'd like to see.
Well, you can't just name one because there's so many things to get done. But we don't have a stable financial situation here in the city of Detroit, and that's the first thing that we've got to do. We've been running the city in a deficit for way too long. We've not managed our finances very, very well, and because of that, city services that the citizens pay their taxes for aren't provided. So I've been in a business that's about performance. It's very performance-oriented as an automotive supplier, and I've got to do the same thing here for the citizens of Detroit.
Well, Mayor-elect Bing, I mean, you're in the auto parts business. I mean, if this economic downturn and the failure of some of the auto companies takes you down, does that bind you closer to the voters, or do people say, well, even Mayor Bing can't even take care of this?
Well, you know, I don't control the automotive industry now. That's a global industry. And when you look at the people who are hurting, who are suffering, who's already gone out of business, you're talking multi-billion dollar companies that are global in reach. So I'm a local supplier, and I think we've managed our way through this whole turmoil pretty well. And that's what's prepared me for what I'm about to take on now.
Well, you have got plenty on your plate and a lot of people rooting for you and the city. Mayor-elect David Bing, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now we go to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you. At 21 minutes to the top of the hour. In international news, at least 17 people are dead in Baghdad today after a car bomb exploded at a fruit and vegetable market. Dozens are wounded. This morning's blast follows a sharp increase in violence from last month. The American journalist Roxana Saberi has ended her two-week-long hunger strike in Iran. She was protesting her conviction and imprisonment on charges of espionage. Her case will get a review by an appeals court next week. In Washington, D.C. City Council voted 12-1 yesterday to recognize same-sex marriages from states that actually approve them. The vote could lead to eventually allowing gay marriages to be performed in the nation's capital. Congress has 30 days to have a final say over the city's laws. If no action is taken, it does become law. And we still have wildfires in Southern California. They're threatening about 2,000 homes. Firefighters are working to hold off the flames there. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And it's perhaps not so hard to imagine, as we were a moment ago, what it's like to be a fish. But what could we learn about the world through the eyes of a virus? Okay, viruses don't have eyes, but they sure do get around in this world, as evidenced by the current H1N1 flu outbreak. So what if we could shrink ourselves down and inject ourselves into the bloodstream of human beings? What would we see then?
For you are going where no man or camera has ventured before. And when you come out, you may never look at yourself in the same way again.
The cheesy trailer of the movie Fantastic Voyage from 1966. But for viruses, these are the best of times. Maybe the worst of times for humans, but for viruses, the best of times. In a 6 billion plus person world, Dr. Susan Fisher-Hawk, epidemiologist at the University of Texas School of Public Health, and thanks for joining us. It's a great time to be a virus, don't you think?
Well, yes, depending on which virus you are. But, you know, I liked your piece of music. That's pretty accurate for the virus.
Is it a myth to think that the proliferation of the population of potential hosts proves to be a boon for viruses, and that as the population of hosts grows, the proliferation of viruses also increases?
Oh, absolutely. It's the large number of people that are available to influenza viruses that may be influencing the increase of strains of viruses that we see circulating.
So are we going to be hearing more and more of these kinds of stories of potential pandemics as the years proceed because of the proliferation of the human population and our ability to communicate and transmit?
Well, possibly. I think we're hearing more about it is the difference. Maybe that's the word, because this has happened forever, in fact, probably. Whenever we had a large enough population for viruses to get around so easily. We haven't had a flu pandemic since 1968, so we were kind of overdue. We used to think they came every 10 years, but we haven't had one since then. So it's not too much of a surprise to a virologist.
And is there any sort of incentive for the virus to be benign to the host, in the sense that killing the host doesn't really help the virus propagate, in the end?
Absolutely. In fact, the biggest success for a virus is not to kill the host. There are just one or two extraordinary exceptions, and one of those is rabies. But mostly the virus does much better if it's relatively symbiotic or at least benign in the host, so that it just sort of sits there, replicates, moves on to the next host, and makes lots of little viruses.
So from the perspective of a virus, it's can't we all just get along? You're right, Dr. Hawk?
Well, no, once again, it's a question of it's random mutations. It's a question of chance. It makes so many changes, and there's no planning as far as a virus is concerned. It just uses the fact that it can change so rapidly to take advantage of a new niche or to overcome some adversity, such as the use of Tamiflu.
Well, that's a virus's view of the world from Dr. Susan P. Fisher-Hawk, epidemiologist at the University of Texas School of Public Health. She's also the co-author of the book Level 4, Virus Hunters of the Centers for Disease Control. She joined us from South Padre Island in Texas. Thank you, Doctor.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're getting closer to a hormonal contraceptive for men, but you got us wondering, who bears the responsibility and cost for birth control? Men, would you be willing to take a shot if it was a contraceptive shot?
I certainly hope that they have contraceptives for men, because we could sure use them. Women are just as untrustworthy as we are, and it's good to protect ourselves.
Call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Oke is here with some headlines.
It's almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. President Obama holds trilateral talks with the leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan at the White House today. The talks come as tens of thousands flee the Swat Valley in Pakistan amid reports that the government is mounting a new attack against militants in the region. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari met with members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday. Now, according to a person who attended the meeting, Zardari confused some committee members when he asked for financial assistance. He compared the international request to the government's bailout of AIG. Detroit has a new mayor-elect, former Detroit Piston Dave Bing. He spoke to us earlier this hour when he explained why he ran for mayor.
Doing that because you love the city, you love the people. This is where I've been for the last 42 years. And the city needs help. The city needs leadership. The city needs a change in direction. And I felt very passionate about that.
Now, the turnout for the election was low. Only 15 to 20% of registered voters turned up at the polls. And Bing will finish out the term of ousted Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. The Boston Globe lives to see another day. That's according to the Globe. Its largest union reached a tentative deal with our partner New York Times earlier this morning. And finally, the right-wing radio talk show host Michael Savage has been banned from the United Kingdom. Savage is on a list of 22 people who are barred from Britain for fostering extremism or hatred. Savage is not amused by the ban.
The issue is no laughing matter. It represents a serious threat to free speech. See, today it's me, tomorrow it's someone else.
Michael Savage has the third largest radio audience in the United States. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
This is a man's world. This is a man's
world. Well, when it comes to sex and reproduction, men have a few power moves on their side. It's their genetic contribution that decides if the baby is a boy or a girl. And of course, if there's a technical failure of the contraception, it's always the woman who ends up pregnant. Unless it's the cross-gendered man who had a baby. But that's not where we're going with this.
That's a big story. We probably lead with that, yeah.
We want to ask, if there was a way for men to use hormonal birth control, and the pill is a form of hormonal birth control, would men actually do it? Would women trust the men to do it right? New research from China's National Institute of Family Planning indicates we're one step closer to a viable form of male contraception. It's a testosterone shot taken once a month, and we've got Dr. John Hare. He is a professor at the University of Virginia, director of UVA's Center for Research in Contraceptive and Reproductive Health. We also have Susie Bright, author of The Sexual State of the Union and host of In Bed with Susie Bright on Audible.com. Hi, guys.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing great, Susie. Great to talk to you. Been a while. Dr. Hare, let me start with you, though. We've been hearing about male contraception for years, and it hasn't exactly caught on. Why not?
Well, I think this particular paper that's just come out really represents a steady advance along the path to the contraceptive. Developing a contraceptive is really pretty complex. You need to test different kinds of drugs and test them in different ways with different delivery systems. And then you also have to test for drug safety and efficacy. And this present report just is an incremental step on this path.
Now, just explain for me the science behind this. Testosterone is what makes men virile. So why does it prevent them from being fertile?
Well, the mechanism, what we'd call the mechanism of action here, is a feedback loop. You give the testosterone, and it basically fools the brain, a part of the brain called the hypothalamus, into thinking that the testes are functioning and or functioning properly, and that causes the hypothalamus to shut down, producing a releasing hormone that affects the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland stops putting out its hormones. And in effect, then spermatogenesis or sperm production in the testis ceases. So it's a systemic effect of the administration of the testosterone on the entire feedback loop in the brain and the whole axis of the pituitary gland and the testis.
Doctor, that's just a technical way of saying, I feel great, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some of the men on the male contraceptive do report that they do feel pretty good. The one of the effects of the still is a mood change, and most men report that it's pretty positive.
All right. I'm going to go to Susie in a second, but just give me a very quick sense of, you know, whether or not this is something which is, I guess, socially acceptable. I mean, is there any sense of, aside from the hard science, whether or not people are actually interested in this?
There's been six or seven papers published in the last 4 or 5 years that have assessed males' interest in contracepting in countries all across the globe. And there is a range. Some countries, it may be 10% of the men are anxious for a new contraceptive, and in other countries it may be as high as 65 or 70%.
Okay, well, so, let me go to Susie. When you
that question, when you ask me that, I mean, if you look at how many men are indeed interested in vasectomies, go through with it, all the men using condoms right now, I mean, the numbers are enormous. Of course, men are interested, but like women, they're picky. You know, you're not just going to poke me with God knows what. You know, you're like, you want to know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, the men want to know what's going to happen. Also the women, because, you know, the men don't get pregnant. But, you
well,
know,
let's do a little experiment then. How does this work for you, Susie? I took my shot.
Right.
So,
so what would you respond to a guy who said that to you?
Who said that to me? Well, I think that is the kind of sexy daydreaming where you imagine this sexy, handsome stranger you met in a bar, and he says to you, "Oh, I'm on the pill," and you're like, "Oh, you're my dream man, but can I trust you?" You know, it's like a telenovela. And
I took my shot.
Yeah, you took your shot. Yeah, sure. It seems like a joke right there. You're the cad. You're the stud. You'll say anything to get in my pants. But the sort of unsexy, plain old bread and potatoes truth of this is that it's married people and people in long-term relationships who get pregnant the most. They're the ones having sex in one day and out the next. I mean, they're the frequent sex users, and they have a strong mutual interest in a birth control that would be easy on both of them, that would work. Many times, husbands have an intense interest in their wives, you know, discomfort with the present birth control method she's using. They both decided they don't want any more accidents, any surprises. I mean, this is something that, you know, doctors and clinics hear about all the time, is couples saying, is there anything we can do now? You know, especially as they get older and the women say, enough already.
Well, let me go back to...
I have four kids, and I have my own room now.
Exactly.
Let me go back to Dr. Hare, though. You know, when you talk about responsible behavior, you know, AIDS researchers have been saying, well, why can't people just use a condom, and, you know, and having trouble getting people to do it? You know, it's like some nights most people don't, you know, someone will forget to floss their teeth. What if a guy forgets a shot? Medically, what happens? And what about behavior?
Well, I think one of the things that this study that recently came out shows is that once the man begins to take the contraceptive, it does take about 100 days on average for them to reach a safe level of sperm. And if they miss one of the, in this case, these were monthly shots, if they do miss one monthly shot, they may get a little blip and the sperm production may come back. So it is important in male contraception to have a companion diagnostic test that will can be used to monitor sperm levels. And it's important to note that recently the FDA has approved something called SpermCheck. And this is the first home test that can detect low concentrations of sperm.
All right, a home test. We have to stop here. Dr. John Hare, a professor at the University of Virginia, and Susie Bright, author of The Sexual State of the Union, thanks so much.
So, who should bear the responsibility and cost for birth control? Men, would they be willing to take a contraceptive shot? You can call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
All scientists have sort of a secret nerdy fascination that they like to pursue, and in my case, I'm just really fascinated by what it's like to be another animal.
Joseph Garner, assistant professor of animal behavior and well-being at Purdue University, telling us that fish feel pain.
We've also been hearing from our listeners about the new mayor elect of Detroit. We'll talk about that a bit more later.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I took my shot. A man with a game plan for the voters.
They want a fast break. They don't want four corners, so I won't give them that. We can't continue to try to operate in a microcosm and say it's Detroit against the world.
Hey, Detroit in the playoffs, not the Pistons. The new mayor, former Piston, now mayor-elect Dave Bing. This is Bing's first election. So is Detroit's long losing streak ending? Lions, Tigers, and Mayors. Oh, my. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, May 6th. Congratulations there to Mayor-elect Bing. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm joined this morning by Farai Chidea.
Hey, John. Coming up this hour, forget about stress tests for banks. We are putting our own personal finances to the test, and then we'll talk about why Mexico's been hit so hard by the swine flu compared with the rest of the world. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
The Treasury Department has allegedly told Bank of America to find some cash fast. It says the bank needs almost $34 billion if it's going to get through the rest of the economic downturn. It's according to some executives at the bank who are shocked by the high figure. The government will release all of its report cards on the nation's biggest banks tomorrow. President Obama holds trilateral talks with the presidents of both Pakistan and Afghanistan at the White House today. Afghan Parliament member Khalid Pashtun says he has high expectations for the meetings.
Hopefully, they will come up with some kind of tripartite solution between the U.S., Pakistan, and Afghanistan, because the Pakistan participation in the bringing peace to the region is extremely important.
More hope from Richard Holbrook, the special envoy for the two regions. He says Pakistan can win the battle against militants.
As they progress, I think we can expect elements of the Taliban. Some will fade back into the villages, like all guerrillas do, and others will go east into Pakistan.
Not much sign of fading, though, right now. The talks come as tens of thousands of civilians flee the Swat Valley in Pakistan in the wake of increasing conflict, Farai.
Well, in Afghanistan, the Red Cross has confirmed that dozens of people, including women and children, died in a coalition air raid in the western part of the country this week. Here's Jessica Berry of the Red Cross.
No matter which side is fighting, when there is fighting, civilians have to be kept safe. They must not be targeted, and they must not be allowed to be involved in the fighting.
American forces are investigating the incident, and Afghan President Hamid Karzai asked for an official inquiry yesterday. Also, the U.S. Navy has been hit by H1N1. The Navy says it won't send a California-based ship on a humanitarian mission to the South Pacific because a crew member has the swine flu. And nearly 50 more sailors are being treated for symptoms. There are now more than 400 confirmed cases of swine flu in the U.S.
Tentative deal for the Boston Globe to live and see another day. The largest union reached a tentative deal with our partner, the New York Times Company, early this morning. Massive pay cuts, unpaid furloughs, and changes in the lifetime job guarantee among the concessions. The Dow opens this hour at 83.65. The S&P starts trading at 8.99. Could you pass a stress test?
Hi, this is John from Long Island. How about asking for a raise from your boss? That's pretty stressful.
Oh, talking about stress tests for banks and other things, tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What would you stress test in your own life? And would you pass?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Banks are getting stress tests. Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry. How would you fare in a stress test? What in your life needs a stress test? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is John from Kingston, New York. I think life is a stress test.
Good point. How would you do if you were a bank? We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But send us your stress test ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I don't know if I'd want to be a bank, Farai.
No, not my number one thing. I might want to be the Pentagon or something. Anyway, stress test tomorrow. Federal officials going to reveal the results. The big question is how banks' finances would hold up if the economy gets worse. And the bank test got us thinking maybe we as individuals need our own stress test. I mean, don't most of us need to know whether or not we're ready to hold our own if we, you know, lose our job or get into credit card debt? To take that question to the next level, we invited a couple of listeners to do a personal finance stress test with our friend and financial guru, Gary Belsky. He is the author of Why Smart People Make Big Money Mistakes and How to Correct Them, Lessons from the New Science of Behavioral Economics. And, you know, Gary, How well do people generally do in assessing their own ability to deal with negative change?
By the way, I'd rather be the Federal Reserve. That way you could print your own money.
Yeah,
you
can, yeah, that's a great thing, having the printing press.
People generally do poorly in times of stress, and that's actually kind of a key point that I sort of want to make. I'll probably make to our listeners as well as everybody out there who are callers and as well as our listeners, which is that in times of trouble, people tend to rely on the most available information. In psychology, it's called the availability problem, which is that when something bad is happening, we assume that that's generally the state of the affairs right now. And what we know over the long run is short-term decisions under times of stress are often poor.
Really?
Yeah. And so what people need to do, you know, there's a very famous example of that was that traffic accidents rose significantly in 2002. And the reason why traffic accidents in the United States rose significantly in 2002 was because people were overestimating the likelihood that somebody would drive a plane into a building. And so instead of flying from Tampa to Cleveland to visit their in-laws, they drove, increasing the likelihood that they would actually die in a traffic accident. And so sometimes the available information is not the most important information.
Can I just get an explanation of the bank metaphor for a moment for the purposes of this little experiment? Banks are required to put reserves aside to show that they're healthy. If regular sort of citizens were required to do that, would we have to have boxes of money all over our house to be able to project that, okay, maybe we're in debt, but we're actually much more financially healthy? Is that what a stress test is all about for a person?
Well, fundamentally, I think there's a couple things that come into play. One is, are we prepared for emergencies, meaning are people still making their insurance payments and things like that? And by the way, by insurance, I actually mean not just health insurance, but disability insurance. That's one of the things that's really important that people often underestimate is the likelihood that they're actually going to be out of work for a time, right? And so that's really important. So one, do you have safety nets built in? Two, do you have income coming in? Obviously, do you have a job? And three, do you have money to keep your lifestyle going for some short period of time, 6 months to 9 months, which is usually how long it takes most people to find a job in the event that you're unemployed. Do you have savings? Or, by the way, do you have credit card debt that has lines of credit? And it's, you know, you don't want to carry credit card balances, but it's awfully good to have credit cards around in case you do get into trouble.
All right. Well, I want to go ahead and introduce one of our listeners. Bridget Lindsay is joining us from Oklahoma City. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So from what I understand, you're married with two sons and you had gotten laid off from your job, but you are doing something really exciting. Tell us just quickly what you're doing.
Well, my husband and I are opening a restaurant. I say we. It's really he's opening a restaurant and I was going to go do have the insurance, have the job with the insurance and the benefits because he's always been the breadwinner. And he was going to go open this restaurant and bar. And as it turns out, 2.5 weeks ago, I got laid off. And now we're both about to open a restaurant.
Bridget, let me ask you a question. When do you still have insurance, meaning are you going to use your COBRA option and actually keep your insurance going?
I got a very generous, in my opinion, severance package, which the company that I was laid off from is going to continue to pay my COBRA premiums until around the end of the year, in fact.
Well, that was a sigh of relief you just heard from me, because that's actually the most important thing, to make sure that your basic kind of emergency situation is covered, and it sounds like it is. First of all, you're one of my favorite people, and not just because you live in a state where the state capital is the same name as the state, but also because I like the idea of sort of investing in troubled times. One of the facts that I like to tell people these days is that Fortune magazine, which I'm sure you've heard of, right, the Fortune 500,
absolutely,
it's sort of the dominant business magazine. It started in the teeth of the Depression. Henry Luce started that magazine when the U.S. economy looked like it was never going to rebound. And so in general, in these times, the people that often win are the people that actually have a long-term outlook as opposed to a short-term outlook. And it sounds like that's what you folks have. How are you going to live day to day going forward? Are you going to be counting on the money from the profits from the deli, or is there going to be a salary for your husband involved?
We actually built into the financial loan, the loan that we set up to start the business includes a monthly salary for him, which will support our family through the next year to. We could manipulate that in the future if we needed to. In addition, like I said, I'll have severance payments coming in from the company that I was laid off from till about the end of August. And that frees me up to work very cheap.
All right. Well, Bridget, I want you to stay with us, but we've also got Jen Rood, who is joining us from Madison Heights, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. You had just started a new job after being out of work for months. Gary, advice.
Well, Jen, first of all, congratulations on getting a new job. You're actually not that alone. One of the things that should make Bridget and you happy is the fact that in February, I think 4.8 million jobs were cut, but also 4.5 million jobs in this country were added. So there's lots of reasons to think that over the long run, we are slowly going to climb out of this economic dullness or torpor that we're in. But the one thing I want to ask both of you is, Jen, you just started your job about a week and a half ago. Do you already, and I know you have a lot of credit card debt and things of that nature, are you planning to at least start out by paying yourself a little bit money from what you're earning? Meaning, one of the things that people tend to do in these kinds of situations is panic a little bit and forget the basics. And the basics of people who have jobs is saving for the time when they don't have jobs, which means whatever you're making, some small percentage of it, even if it's $50 a week, needs to go into an emergency savings account. Are you doing that, or are you planning to do that?
I'm planning to try to do that.
Don't try. It's really important. You are the first person you need to say you need to pay, even before your mortgage and even before your credit card debt or other kinds of debt. You have a lot of debt, right?
Yeah, quite a bit. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is credit card debt?
A lot of it is credit card debt. I also have school loan debt.
Okay. Well, the school loan debt and the credit card debt are actually more manageable than people often realize. In both cases, you can actually get a lot of help from the people who lend you the money, right? Both the government from the school loan debt and the credit card companies are often very willing to negotiate and sometimes even forgive debt in the event that you're having problems. The key with both of them, and this is what people often forget in times of stress, that's what we're talking about, is that you actually have to talk to them. You actually have to call them up and let them know that you're having problems, and they will go out of their way to have to not write off your debt, but rather to actually work with you and stretch it out if you need to sort of allow you not to default. And that's actually an option that people need to take advantage of, and they'll often help you by forgiving some of the debt even.
So if the creditors are the shareholders for Jen, where's her TARP, Gary, huh?
Well, first of all, hopefully maybe her TARP is, her mom and dad or people like that who love you. It's actually not embarrassing to sort of say that you have to depend on people around you who actually sort of might have a bigger financial cushion. But her TARP is her job. She actually has a job. Congratulations. And that's actually an important.
Right. Thank you.
Well, it strikes me that up on the screen right now on one of the other news organizations, CNN, it's saying that Bank of America's stress test shows it needs $34 billion. Maybe just quickly you could ask what these folks might need to cushion.
Well, the thing ultimately that you want from people to have is, Jen, do you have any savings at all? Or Bridget, do you guys have any savings at all?
I have some savings. It's been depleted and not really been added to because I actually was laid off for about 5 months last year, and then I lost my job again this year. So it's been really difficult for me to really try to save like I was a few years ago, due to, the pay cut in the last job that I had and trying to catch up from the 5 months that I was off work. And
okay, but you have savings now, right? I mean, you have income coming in now, right?
Well, I do have income coming in now, yes.
Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb is always to sort of have 6 to 9 months of savings, for basically your basic living expenses. And in a funny way, it sounds like Jen had that and sort of burned through most of it, which is appropriate. But now that the key, again, is to maintain the level of savings is to keep contributing to your savings account even as you start paying off a lot of your debt.
All right, guys, we are going to have to wrap it up there. But
it's all about reserves, right?
It's just
all about reserves.
So exactly. Critical. Jen Rood, Bridget Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yep,
and of course,
you can come visit Midtown Deli.
Okay, we will.
In Oklahoma City.
Okay,
yep, and Gary Belsky, thank you. It's smart advice there, which is much needed. I'll take it.
My pleasure.
It sounds like those two, if they had not even close to $35 billion, would be doing a lot better.
They'd be doing okay, but so would I, actually.
Right. I could use just $1
billion. Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And all across Europe, the big headline this morning is that NATO begins a month of military exercises in Georgia. Normally, that wouldn't be a big headline here in the United States, but there are two details that maybe tell a different story. Number one, Georgia, the breakaway former Soviet republic, is not a member of NATO, and these NATO exercises come less than a year after the war Georgia lost with Russia over two breakaway republics inside the territory of Georgia. For more, we turn to the BBC's Russia Affairs analyst Stephen Eek in London. In our interview conducted earlier this morning, I asked Stephen to tell us the significance of these NATO exercises, given that on the surface, they are a test of the tensions between Georgia and Russia.
NATO actually says that it doesn't want these exercises in Georgia to be seen as a test, a litmus test or a stress test, as we've just been hearing, of relations between East and West, between NATO and Russia. NATO insists that Georgia is merely hosting these exercises and that it doesn't want any other sort of interpretation to be put on that. However, given that they're taking place in Georgia, which has a very poor relationship with Moscow, and given that last August Georgia lost a war with Russia over two breakaway regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, it was inevitably going to be very, very controversial. And what we've seen is that effectively these exercises have derailed the process of restoring links between NATO and Russia that had just started to get underway after last August's war. If you listen to Russian officials, they're very angry. They say that this is muscle flexing, it's a provocation, and that given the instability inside Georgia, NATO should really be focusing its attention on that particular problem. It's interesting to look at the very colourful language that Russia's envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, was using just yesterday. He said that NATO might just as well conduct these manoeuvres in a madhouse.
Well, if NATO doesn't want the interpretation that this is muscle flexing in the interpretation of the Russians, why don't they just cancel these operations?
Two reasons. NATO says, first of all, look, these were planned way before the events of August last year. There's a great
They always
deal.
Say that, though.
Well, they say that. I mean, that's a convenient administrative and bureaucratic excuse, of course. The other major reason for this, I believe, is that NATO has given not a fixed commitment to membership for Georgia, but it has said that at some stage in the future, providing Georgia continues to pursue its pro-Western policies of integration with NATO, with the European Union, of putting in places that the reforms that are necessary, it will actually join NATO. NATO, of course, has said the same thing to Ukraine. Seen from the Russian perspective, that is extremely provocative. After all, NATO has expanded into Central Europe and then further onto the Baltic states since the fall of communism, and Moscow has tolerated that policy varyingly, acceptingly. But the red line, if you like, for Moscow is Georgia and Ukraine. Let's not forget that Russia actually wants to see regime change in Georgia. It doesn't like President Saakashvili. It believes him to be destabilizing and dangerous. And Mr. Saakashvili himself, of course, is in a difficult position, which the Russians are using to try to forge ahead with that policy aim of their own.
Well, Saakashvili's relationship with Washington is a bit of an unknown at this point. Certainly got a lot of support last August when the Russians invaded. Is it possible that the commencement of these NATO, war games or whatever it is, military operations in Georgia, is a sign that the Barack Obama administration really doesn't have a Russia policy ready to roll out and is just letting this proceed because it really doesn't have its policy in order?
Well, I think it would be premature to talk about a policy vacuum. After all, there are the foreign policy experts who are working on U.S. policy towards Russia, largely the same as under the previous administration of President Bush. However, if you look at the difference in rhetoric and the difference in public attitudes, at least, then we see something really rather different from the agenda pursued by former President Bush and certainly by Condoleezza Rice, who, of course, was an expert on the former Soviet Union and a key proponent of expansion into Western institutions for the countries that were once part of the Soviet Union. What we're actually waiting is for for something slightly firmer than anodyne statements of calling for Georgia to remain peaceful, for it to remain calm, for political solution to that country's now chronic instability to be found. But the decision is actually a very, very difficult one for Washington. Does Washington effectively turn its back on countries that are still, despite internal difficulties, pursuing a pro-Western agenda merely to appease Moscow? That looks very unlikely.
Well, go ahead.
I say, however, the Russians have actually seen, I believe, a window of opportunity to halt a process they view as inherently hostile to their own national interest.
Well, what do you make then of Saakashvili's government? And the Russians have made no secret that they want regime change. Yesterday, the Interior Ministry inside Georgia said it had uncovered a Russian-supported plan to overthrow President Saakashvili. The Russians deny it. But these are disturbing sort of details if the tensions rise from this point onward.
There are chronic political tensions inside Georgia, which we've seen not just in the form of street demonstrations now continuing for many weeks, demanding President Saakashvili resigns, but also in a succession of alleged plots that have been broken by the Georgian government and its special services, allegedly, repeatedly backed by Russia. Very little solid evidence has appeared of this, it has to be said, raising lots of questions of whether Mr. Saakashvili is attempting to bolster domestic support. And he is increasingly unpopular. That's an important fact to state. The question being, of course, whether he's trying to bolster support by saying Georgia has a powerful external enemy. But Mr. Saakashvili was seriously wounded, metaphorically, by losing the war in August last year with Russia. An interesting development I want to mention also in that respect is the agreement signed some 10 days ago between Russia and Georgia's two breakaway regions, which effectively puts their borders under Russian control. That is yet another sign of how far those two regions have slipped from Georgia's control.
And so the NATO exercises go for an entire month. The fact that, for the next 4 weeks we're going to be dealing with this, wouldn't it be better if this was just a matter of days?
NATO isn't going to scupper its plans that have been in the pipeline for a long time to appease Moscow at this stage. It'll be interesting now to see whether Russia actually goes ahead and further severs its links with NATO just as they were restarting. Certainly a very tense atmosphere.
And only a month to sort of bring those tensions down. My guest, BBC Russian Affairs analyst Stephen Eek, speaking to us on NATO exercises currently underway in Georgia. Stephen Eek joined us from London for that interview we conducted earlier this morning. And now some headlines. Catch us up, Femi, okay?
I'll do my best at 29 minutes past the hour. President Obama meets with the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan in Washington today. The president is expected to press Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari to do more to stop the growing militant violence within Pakistan's borders. Health officials will be discussing the H1N1 virus in front of a House panel on Capitol Hill today. That comes a day after a 33-year-old Texas woman with swine flu died yesterday. But it's not clear whether the virus caused her death, as she had a chronic health condition. And calming winds have helped firefighters hold off wildfires in Southern California. The fire has forced the evacuation of 1,200 homes. That's a quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Gary Belsky was in here a moment ago talking about stress tests for banks and consumers. What stress tests apply to your own life? Gary, not Belsky, emails us with some of his, including postmarital sex. That's a stress test. The stress of testing an elementary and middle school students. The stress of actually taking tests on students. Post-9/11 stress. The use of music to relieve stress. Here's another stress test.
This is Nancy from Lexington, Massachusetts. My daily stress is raising kids, especially adolescents, especially those between the ages of 15 and 19. I think I have a lot of gray hair just because of that.
How are you doing with your own stress tests in your life? Tell us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Rock City or Motown or just Detroit, and now it's got a new mayor. Voters last night elected Dave Bing, a former Detroit Pistons basketball star who'd never run for political office, as the city's next mayor. Noah Ovshinsky is a political reporter for WDET in Detroit. He did us a solid yesterday, told us what was going on with the election. You've been covering this race, and the incumbent mayor, Ken Cockrell, was leading in the polls. So was this a surprise?
You know, I think to some degree it was. As you said, Cockrell was leading in the last several weeks. And the Cockrell camp seemed, you know, supremely confident of victory. So certainly last night was an upset. It wasn't a landslide, but it certainly was a decisive victory for Dave Bing.
But it really sort of played off of what you were saying yesterday, that there were people in Detroit who have had it with what's been going on, who really want some kind of spiritual change, whether the candidate fits that or not. It seems to me a lot of people sort of got in their cars, went to the polls, and decided to turn the page.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, even though Cockrell was up in those polls, there were still a lot of undecided. And it's still early to tell, but it seems that a lot of those undecided voters, right, they wanted the change, the message of change, which Bing, you know, hammered home during every campaign appearance. It really spoke to people. And as we talked about yesterday, you know, this is a city that has been rocked by political controversy for the last few years now. And I think people are just, they're just tired.
Bing is someone who's a businessman, and specifically in the auto parts industry. So do we have any sense about how his personal fortunes have fared?
Yeah, I mean, he's been vague, but he has hinted that his business has certainly taken a hit as a result of the struggles in the industry. But he has been vague, and he said that he's going to relinquish control of his companies to you know, several relatives as well as executives that he trusts. And he said that he's not going to have any sort of day-to-day decision-making with those companies as soon as he takes over as mayor.
Now, when we think about turnout, we talked about there possibly being a 15% turnout yesterday. Do we have any updates on that?
Yeah, you know, we don't have any solid numbers yet, but I'd be real surprised if it's anything beyond 15%. And frankly, it'll likely be somewhat lower.
When you think about that level of enfranchisement, does it reflect a profound cynicism that government can work at all, or perhaps a lack of confidence in either of the two candidates? What do you, from talking, you've talked to so many people, what do you chalk this up to?
Well, you know, we had a soundbite on the show yesterday morning where this guy, this gentleman, was just like, you know, I've got to pay rent. I've got to put a roof over my head. I've got to pay for food. I can't manage this all. And he seemed very cynical on city government. And I think that is a widespread belief here in Detroit. You know, the city services are really in bad shape right now. We've lost, you know, 900 cops in the last few years. We haven't had a new firefighters class in a while. The state of affairs isn't good. And I think people are, you know, I think they're too wrapped up in their own lives and making their ends meet. And I think there's a disconnect between who they think is in the political leadership and actually what happens on the street, because all they see is response times with cops getting longer, potholes growing larger, and streetlights going out.
So you've had this concatenation of events where Kilpatrick was convicted, then you have in Cockrell, now you've got Bing, but he's going to have to go up again in November for the regular election. That is a very fast turnaround. Does it put him at a disadvantage that he will have a record that can be judged so quickly that may or may not be complete?
Well, I mean, you know, Cockrell was in the mayor's chair for
True.
7 months, and it seems like that audition in the end didn't go very well. But again, Bing, you know, he said last night, he was very clear. He said, look, I'm not going to worry about campaigning. I've got staff in place. I've won one. Actually, he's won two, the primary and the general yesterday. And he said, I'm going to go about the business of running this city. And like Cockrell, I think the first few months are going to be spent just hemorrhaging the red ink, trying to get a handle on the city's deficit.
Give me just one quick hit on another key player. Who besides the mayor is really shaping the city?
Oh, another person. I think city council, I can't say one individual, but I think city council has been very vocal in the last several months and have asserted their sort of position in city government. So I think it'll remain to be seen what Cockrell's relationship will be with council.
Do you mean Bing's relationship?
Bing's relationship and Bing's relationship with Cockrell, because Ken Cockrell will go back as the city council president.
Right.
And so they're going to have to work very closely together in the next several months.
Well,
and, you know, there were also several council members at Bing's celebration party last night.
So that
may be indicative of something.
That's fascinating. Noah Ovshinsky, a political reporter for WDET in Detroit. Always great to hear from you and always great to hear from Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Car bombs have struck the Iraqi capital again today. At least 15 people were killed by a blast at the entrance to a fruit and vegetable market, and about 40 were injured in that attack. And a second bomb in another part of the capital also killed two more people and wounded six. NATO troops from 18 countries are taking part in drill exercises in the Republic of Georgia today, and that's not sitting well with Russia. Moscow says the drill is provoking them following the war with Georgia last year. Texas health officials are announcing the first death of a U.S. resident with swine flu. The 33-year-old teacher apparently had other medical conditions, so authorities are stopping short of saying she died from the virus. And meanwhile, schools in the Texas district where she taught are being closed until Monday. The Boston Globe newspaper has reached a tentative deal with its largest union early this morning to keep it printing. The union agreed to massive pay cuts, unpaid furloughs and changes in the lifetime job guarantee. And the Globe is owned by our partner, the New York Times. Actor Dom DeLuise has died at the age of 75. Dom was proud that he pretty much used his real personality in his acting roles.
I like to make it less different when I perform and when I am. A lot of times people meet me and they go, holy mackerel, you really are like you are.
DeLuise was known for parts including Dominic the Great on The Dean Martin Show and also the director in the Mel Brooks film Blazing Saddles. That's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Greetings, friends and readers at the Marwood Worcester. It would seem that our secret is out, and my humble musings have attracted a somewhat wider audience. Those are the words of a British soldier named Michael Saunders, who's been sending home accounts of his first few weeks in Afghanistan as part of the NATO force there, one of 8,000 British troops in Afghanistan. It's a blog that ended up in a pub and in a combination of sort of high-tech, low-tech communications in the 21st century. We're joined now by Michael Saunders' sister, Tracy Tyrrells, who is in Worcester, a town near Birmingham, England. Tracy, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Explain how a blog becomes something of a community shrine in a pub called the Marwood.
Right. Well, my brother Michael had a chat with my boss, Ben, over a good pint of beer. And my boss was asking, well, how do you keep in touch with your family? How do you let them know how things are for you there? And Mike said, well, I'll send you a blog each week. And Ben said, well, if you send me a blog, I'll put it on the wall and all the customers can read it.
And, you know, most people, you know, have Facebook pages and, you know, digital representations of a kind of wall in a pub. But is there something about the reality of the posting and people actually standing there holding a pint, talking about what your brother is saying that makes it more real?
Very much so. I think it's more community-minded because he's obviously a very popular person, you know, in Worcester here. The Mercian Regiment, the Worcester Sherwood Foresters are, you know, originally based from this hometown. So there's a community spirit. And in general, people want to know what's going on in Afghanistan because there seems nothing but negative coverage on the BBCs and the general news and radio websites. So it's good to have a more sort of personal point of view aspect of it.
Well, what's in his latest blog that would represent that kind of alternative view than you might get in the media?
Well, the eighth blog that he sent now is a little bit more personal and talks about a soldier in Afghanistan with the Mercian force that has been wounded for a second time, and how the troops were able to get out of a very difficult situation and save themselves, really.
And how does that play in the pub? I mean, what do people say when they read Michael's posts, and how do they talk about the British decision to remain in the NATO force?
Well, I think ultimately most people feel that they know so little about it, and that's an important point to make. Not just the negative side, but also the positive. The changes that the British and American forces are making for the Afghan people, and the changes that my brother has noticed in the 2 years since he's been there, so that people can have a life. It's all very important issues that need to be brought to the forefront. And just keeping the troops in our mind's eye so that we are remembering what they're doing and why they're there.
Well, you know, Tracy, it seems like there's another change as well. You know, Michael has managed to figure out a way to upgrade Facebook by putting it in a pub.
It's amazing. I can't believe the amount of contact we've had with regards to the blog and the live links that I've done through radio with Michael in Afghanistan as well.
And the livest link of all is there at the Marwood in Worcester. Where is
That's
it posted
right.
exactly? Where?
We've got next to the bar. We have a picture board that we've made a collage of troop photographs.
Very important
placement.
And then
we post Michael's. We just change them as he sends them.
All right, we'll get an update. Michael Saunders, British soldier serving in Afghanistan. You can find it right up there next to the bar at the Marwood in Worcester, England, a town near Birmingham. Tracy Terrell's sister of Michael Saunders joined us. Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you very much.
Very sweet.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Stress testing banks and hearts. And what is stress testing you in your life? Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Stop stress testing me, Femi, okay? Just do the news, okay?
I was just stressed by a priest on news, cable news. He was too absolutely amazingly good-looking to be a priest.
Stop!
Amazing. That is why Farai hesitated when she said, I'm Farai.
Well,
straight. I have to say, my friend Danzy Senna has a new great memoir out, and I only mention it because...
You're her friend.
Her grandmother had a 25-year affair with a priest, and it produced two kids. But moving right along.
That is not the lead story today.
But it's a juicy one. Good morning, everybody. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Here's your real news. In California, a wildfire threatens 2,000 homes in Santa Barbara. Low winds have helped firefighters battle the blaze with helicopters. Detroit has a new mayor-elect, its former Detroit Piston Dave Bing. Now, we spoke to him earlier this morning when he explained why he ran for office.
Doing that because you love the city, you love the people. This is where I've been for the last 42 years. And the city needs help. The city needs leadership. The city needs a change in direction. And I felt very passionate about that.
Bing will finish out the term of ousted Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, and turnout for the election was pretty low. Only 15% to 20% of registered voters showed up at the polls. Washington, D.C. City Council has voted to recognize same-sex marriages from states that approve them. Congress has the final say over the city's laws, and the Congress now has 30 days to actually review the bill. And that's a look at your news for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
John.
So we've been telling you the story for many days now. The H1N1 influenza outbreak began in Mexico and caused all kinds of concern around the world. Act 1 was in Mexico. Act 2 was in Washington.
Thus far, the strain in this country has not been as potent or as deadly. We can't know for certain why that is, which is why we are taking all necessary precautions in the event that the virus does turn into something worse.
But concern about fatalities taking place in Mexico, where the flu outbreak was centered, continued until last weekend, when the CDC's Dr. Richard Besser said maybe it's the case that the virus isn't that significant in Mexico.
As we learn more about how widespread this is, it may be that the rates of severe disease in Mexico will end up being not different than what we see here.
26 people have died of the flu in Mexico, while only two have died here in the United States. But what are the public health lessons for a 21st century flu outbreak, which suggests both about the way information is transmitted as well as viruses are transmitted? We're joined now by Dr. Julio Frank, who's the former Mexican Minister of Health and now Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Frank, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
It seems to me there are a lot of lessons here from a purely public health perspective, both about information transmission and virus transmission. What's at the top of your list?
Well, first of all, what we've learned is that no matter how prepared we are, we can never exactly predict when an epidemic and where an epidemic is going to occur. The world had been expecting an event like this at least since 2003 after the SARS outbreak. We knew we were due for an outbreak of human influenza, but all eyes were turned to Asia. Everyone thought that's where it was going to appear, and it appeared in the Americas. So the lesson, the number one lesson, is everyone needs to be prepared because no one knows exactly when and where something like this is going to happen.
Now, Asia, of course, has had the incidence of SARS and avian flu. Yet, you know, it's easy to get into a situation where you think, all right, population density, population centers are the place where these kinds of outbreaks begin. Is the fact that Mexico City, 16 million population, is so huge, does that suggest it's a suspect like other large cities in taking a look at where the outbreak might happen next?
Sure. I mean, large concentrations of human beings facilitate the transmission. Bear in mind that this virus is a new thing. It's a new entity. It didn't exist. And what has made this and still should be a cause for concern is the fact that it has sustained human-to-human transmission. This is the big difference with respect to the avian flu outbreaks that we saw in Asia since 2005. Those had very limited human-to-human transmission. The difference here is that it began to be transmitted, and it has proved to be sustained, and it has now spread to more than 20 countries. It is true that the epicenter is in Mexico, and especially in Mexico City, but the virus has been traveling around the world, and although fortunately it's less severe than we expected, I don't think we can still let our guard down because we don't know what will happen in the fall as the new flu season comes in the northern hemisphere. Also, bear in mind that right now, in the southern hemisphere of this planet is entering into the regular flu season as they go into the fall and winter months. So we need to keep still, as a world community, a vigilant attitude with respect to how this particular outbreak is going to evolve. I don't think we're yet in a position where we can say this is over. We can now relax. Not at all. I think without creating any sort of panic, we should, on the other hand, continue to be vigilant.
Dr. Frank, what do you think the public health infrastructure in, say, Mexico City has learned from this? What are, you know, if there is, for example, a bad seasonal flu coming up, you just mentioned the seasonal flus, what might they do differently?
Once we do the full dissection of what has happened in this opportunity, I think it will become clear that detecting an abnormality like this against the backdrop of regular seasonal flu that here in Mexico causes about 10,000 deaths every year, the first cases here obviously appeared while we were still at the tail end of the regular flu season. And you require a pretty refined surveillance system to be able to detect, you know, in this case, a few cases against the backdrop of a regular flu season in a country of 110 million people. And in my opinion, the surveillance systems did work because they detected the anomaly that most of the deaths were occurring in healthy young adults, which is not what happens with regular flu. And that's what's got the alarms off, set in motion the steps that took within a few weeks to the full genetic sequencing and the realization that we were in the face of a whole new virus.
So early detection was really favorable here, but how do you track the public awareness, which rippled around the world almost immediately? It seems to me the information public health message here is when Dr. Sanjay Gupta comes to town from CNN and starts broadcasting 24 hours a day, you have to be really worried if you're a Mexico City public health authority.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very delicate balance between not providing full disclosure in order not to worry people, and on the other hand, going to the other extreme of creating undesirable effects of undue worry or even paralysis of economic activity. It's a very, very tough balance to achieve. I think my scorecard in this case is I think the alarm level was raised enough that the world reacted, and probably the reason we're not seeing many more cases and deaths is because countries have responded. I think in the case of Mexico, it was particularly valuable that the president, Mr. Felipe Calderón, personally headed the response to the emergency, because that sent a signal to the population that this was serious. And it was and still is a serious matter. As I said, the worst-case scenarios have not materialized, but let's not forget that in 1918, the initial outbreaks in the spring died out during the summer, the humid summer's months, and then came back with a vengeance in the fall. We need to be preparing now, particularly for immunization in the fall months. The preparation for the vaccine against this specific strain is already underway, and we need to keep the surveillance measures with very clear communication to the population. I think alongside the epidemic, or to deal with an epidemic like this, the two major pillars are good surveillance and clear, transparent, and precise, and timely communication.
Well, a real-world pilot project students at the Harvard School of Public Health will no doubt be looking at all year now. Dr. Julio Frank is the former Mexican Minister of Health from 2000 to 2006. He's also Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, telling us some lessons from the swine flu outbreak. Thank you very much, Doctor.
And we've been talking about stress this morning. This is We Wait to Hear Tomorrow, the results of stress tests on our nation's banks. So what are you doing in your life? Life's always stressful. What are you doing to stress test yourself? Stress test your health, blood pressure, family life? Is that your source of stress?
John Dartmouth Math. I would take my economic downturn stress test. I've made it through the 80s. I made it through the 90s. I'll make it through this downturn in 2000. And I'll trust that everything will work out all right, and that'll be my test.
He survived the 80s. He survived Journey.
Yeah. You can always go to our website, thetakeaway.org, to hear more of these stories. And tell us yours, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm not feeling very stressful because I'm with...
Farai Chidea.
And
this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I am Captain Chaos.